This is the Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, with Jonathan Hutton, Chad Withrow, and Paul Kuharski on 104.5 The Zone.
Glad you're with us. The second hour is here. Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue. Chad, I know you're hungry. Paul?
Always.
Where would you go? Would you go to Poncho and Lefty's or Edley's today?
No, until I get the big brisket family meal, that's top of list, and I'm overdue to go get that again, hopefully this week.
Chad?
I'm feeling Poncho and Lefty's today.
Oh.
The salad?
Thinking about going south of the border.
You're going to go get the salad?
That's what my mind is right now.
You know, they do have a nice burrito bowl and a cantina salad at Poncho and Lefty's. PonchoandLefty's.com, the website, tacos, tequila, beer. We heard from Coach Mack, and I mentioned going into the first hour break there. It's like we're having coach to coach on the show today because we say hello to Coach Doug Matthews, who joins us for the second consecutive day. Some news that will be coming out today with the SEC. The presidents are meeting, Coach, and that means they're discussing the upcoming season. And I wonder if we'll hear news today like we heard from the ACC yesterday, or if they're just discussing options to be tabled for a later decision day point.
Well, you mentioned coach to coach. By the way, it officially starts next Saturday. It'll be on the zone at 7 o'clock a.m. For the next 52 weeks after that, assuming Coach Mack is able to do the show. You know, he's getting a little bit older now, so be a little bit more careful with him on that. Really interesting, and all this kind of ties in, Jonathan, yesterday after we had the show yesterday, what the Atlantic Coast Conference did. Very interesting. First off, let me just kind of put this in perspective. The Southeastern Conference and the Atlantic Coast Conference has been kind of loosely, and I use the term loosely, kind of working together on how they're going to work all this. The Big Ten, the Pac-12, we know that did what they did, conference only. The Big 12 was a little part of it, but the problem that the Big 12 had was they had 9 conference games and wanted to do a few other things. But the Southeastern Conference and the Atlantic Coast Conference all had 8 conference games. So they were working together. In the president's meeting yesterday with the Atlantic Coast Conference, and the presidents of the Southeastern Conference are meeting today, they were taking up the recommendations from their athletic directors, and the plan was to either approve them or not, in all likelihood approve them. And then this would all be announced next week, kind of in conjunction. Well, for whatever reason, and I have my suspicion on why, the Atlantic Coast presidents, Jesse, they just accelerated things and made the vote yesterday on the 10 conference game plus one for the Atlantic Coast Conference. The reason I think they did it was, and this is just speculation, but I think they probably said, hey, this is going to happen anyway. We got a lot more on our plate, we the presidents, than just the athletic department. We're having to meet on this every week. Let's get this out of the way. Let our athletic directors handle it now, and we can move on to other things. I suspect that's what's happening. You're going to see the same thing in the Southeastern Conference today. Yesterday, the athletic directors for the Southeastern Conference recommended to the presidents that it be a 10-game conference schedule only. Again, we were talking about 8+1, 8+2. That's what they recommended. So the presidents will vote on that today. Now, whether they will make that public like the Atlantic Coast Conference did or not, or they'll go into next week as was planned, we'll see on that. Even though the athletic directors, and here's the point, the athletic directors recommended only a 10 conference game schedule with no non-conference games. All right. Whether the presidents will kick that around and may say, well, since the Atlantic Coast Conference is playing one, since 4 teams in this league have an in-state rival, maybe we will do that too. That hadn't been worked out. But what has been worked out is the Southeastern Conference will also play a 10-game conference schedule. So that's where we are right now. Is there still opportunities for the Big 12 and the Southeastern Conference to do some things? Yes, but not if they make it a strictly 10-game conference schedule. A couple of things on that. One of the reasons why the Atlantic Coast Conference presidents voted 10 conference plus one was because of those in-state rivalries with the four ACC teams. So what they are counting on now, and it was kind of the vote, the plus one was simply to placate those programs. Clemson, South Carolina, Louisville, Kentucky, Georgia, Georgia Tech, Florida, Florida State. That's why they put that in there. Will the Southeastern Conference go along with that? Those four schools in the Southeastern Conference probably will like to, but that's not set yet. One other thing that the Atlantic Coast Conference, this is pretty key too. One of the reasons they did what they did for 1 year now, and this is pretty hefty stuff here. For 1 year now, Notre Dame will be a full member of the Atlantic Coast Conference in football for one solid year. Only one season. Now, they've already had all their other sports are full-fledged members. But to be able to do that, Notre Dame had to agree to put all of the TV money that they are getting into the pot, and it will now be divided 15 ways. So, winner and what we have seen happen on this, when the Pac-12 and when the Big Ten went to conference only, that really put Notre Dame in a tough position. They had no conference to go to, so effectively they're a full-fledged Southeastern Conference member, but this year only.
So
excuse me, Atlantic Coast Conference, I beg your pardon.
Doug, what do you think about in the plan that was floated out there yesterday that you're discussing that I think Sports Illustrated had a story on, said that the most likely scenario would be adding the next two cross-division games, that's not your constant rival, Tennessee-Alabama, for instance, the next two on the schedule to round out the 10 conference-only games. So in that scenario, it would be Tennessee hosting Ole Miss, Tennessee traveling to LSU as their bonus two games that they would add. Is that the plan in all of this, or is that scheduling element of it, of which two teams you would add to your schedule, will that all be decided later?
Well, let's look at one thing that'll go right into this. Here's why the Southeastern Conference athletic director said, let's not play a non-conference game, because everybody has four non-conference games. By contract, now some of them, like Tennessee, have into the contract that if there's a crisis or an emergency, that you don't have to pay that. You can cancel that ball game. Most don't. So what the Southeastern Conference athletic directors have said is, if we just choose one of those teams to be our non-conference opponent, let's say that Georgia takes Georgia Tech, the other three programs are probably going to have legal recourse if they want to take it. If the conference as a whole does it, in other words, they say we're strictly going to play conference games, then that lets all those teams off the hook. That's number one. As far as what those two games will be added, here's what I can tell you, Chad, and we've talked about this almost since we started talking about this. They had a plan in place for 10 games. So that's already been scheduled. All right. They have that plan. They know, the Southeastern Conference knows who those two teams are. Now, whether they will make that available, we will not know. One interesting thing about the Atlantic Coast Conference, while they set the schedule on who was going to be playing who in conference, they did not set the dates to be played. That's to be determined later. I'm assuming that's probably what the Southeastern Conference is going to do also. One other big key on that is too, you know, if you play 10 games, every team gets five home games, every team gets five away games. I'm sure there's some quibbling on who's going to play who. You know, if you're a Western Conference team, you probably don't want to be playing Georgia and Florida the same year. You know, I mean, is that fair when somebody else may be playing Vanderbilt and whoever, you know? So, but that's going to be part of this year. So the only thing we're looking at right now is two things from a Southeastern Conference perspective. Will the presidents, they're certainly going to vote on it today, will they let the athletic directors announce it next week, or will they announce it today after the meeting with the chancellor? That's the big thing. And will it be 10 games conference only, or will it be 10 games plus one or maybe possibly two? But best guess is right now. And again, what is key here is that the athletic directors voted zero non-conference games, a 10 conference games schedule. So will the presidents override that?
Doug, I'm ready to hit the fast forward button and hear you and Tony and Charles and John Chavis discuss this on Saturday morning.
We got a lot of things. And of course, Tony Barnhart is right. He is right in the middle of all this. He has had access to all of, not all, but many of the athletic directors in both leagues. Saturday, he will have a really excellent update because we're going to know here probably in a couple of hours what the Southeastern Conference has done. But this is pretty good stuff. And the 10 game conference schedule, I personally really like, because you're going to get 10 quality games. And if they allow plus one, that would allow Tennessee to play Oklahoma. That would allow LSU to play Texas and other teams, Arkansas to play Notre Dame, Notre Dame, Missouri to play BYU. So if they do that, fine. But it looks like right now we're going to be playing a 10-game Southeastern Conference schedule at the very, very least.
Doug, thank you as always. Bonus time with you presented by the Tennessee Highway Safety Office, and we'll be listening this weekend.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, great info. Doug Matthews there with us. Always great chatting with Coach. When we come back, we always enjoy our chats with Dr. Bill Schaffner. And, Chad, that means we can use the hashtag Dr. Bill, hashtag Dr. Bill on Twitter, and we can read our listeners' top COVID-19 questions of the week to the world-renowned infectious disease expert.
This is an area where our listeners have been very helpful with some great questions for Dr. Bill Schaffner. Again, hashtag Dr. Bill, or just reply to us, mention us at Midday 180. We'll see your questions, and we'll ask some of those better questions to Dr. Bill Schaffner next.
Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue. This is 104.5 The Zone.
Because more of them is what you said you wanted. Wait, who am I kidding? They begged for the extra hour. Get more Jonathan Hutton, Chad Withrow, and Paul Kuharski on the 180 at 6. Tonight from 6 to 7 p.m. on 104.5 The Zone.
Glad you're with us here on the 180, here on 104.5 The Zone. We're queued up by Edley's Barbecue. Always great to be joined by Dr. Bill Schaffner, the world-renowned infectious disease expert, and he's with Vanderbilt University Medical Center, and he joins us weekly and has done so. A big thanks to him. He's done that weekly since March, and it's always been informative news we can use surrounding COVID-19 and the coronavirus pandemic. Dr. Bill, great to see you.
Good to see you, John, Chad, Paul. Always good to be with you.
And we, Chad, we have Twitter available, hashtag Dr. Bill, hashtag Dr. Bill. That's how our listeners can interact with Dr. Schaffner today.
Yeah, and we're already getting some questions rolling in right now, but definitely use the hashtag Dr. Bill. If it's okay with you guys, I can start with a question from our audience. That's a good one. Michael on Twitter, using the hashtag Dr. Bill, says this week the World Health Organization said that it looks like the COVID-19 was one big wave instead of it being seasonal with potential second wave. What is the difference with those distinctions, and how should this help us in dealing with the virus?
Well, Chad and Michael, I don't think it will help us a great deal. We had hoped that when things got hot and humid in the temperate zone here where we live, that this virus would abate and its transmission would be slowed down. That certainly hasn't happened. It's kind of out of control over most of the country. So we're having one large continuing wave that will get us into the fall, I think. And then COVID will be joined by influenza to make everybody's life even more difficult, I'm afraid.
Doctor, we always hear that vaccines take years to develop. And now we're hearing that multiple vaccines are already in the final stages of testing. If one is approved and released before the end of the year, how do we go about being sure that it's safe, effective, with such a condensed window of development and testing based on what we've seen in previous vaccine timeframes, if that makes sense.
Oh, Jonathan, it's right on the mark. So let's take this one step at a time. First, I want to assure everyone that nobody's cutting any corners. We're actually able to work faster for three reasons. One is the scientific background was already laid, so we didn't have to do years of work in the laboratory before a vaccine was developed. We can go into that more if you want. Number two, everybody literally is working day and night and on the weekends, so that shortens things somewhat. But most importantly, we're doing some things simultaneously that we used to do in sequence. And that's where we pick up most of our time. For example, we're now entering the large phase of study of at least some of these vaccines. So we don't know if they're going to work yet, but we're already manufacturing the vaccine. When we come to the end of the trial and we see how well the vaccine works, if it does, and how safe it is, if it's safe, then we'll already have a warehouse full of vaccine ready to use. If the vaccine doesn't work, we're just going to junk all that vaccine that we've already made. We would never use it on anybody. We would just have to destroy it. We've made a financial investment. We bet on a horse and didn't win. Right. Well, it's only money. And we're doing this in order to try to get the vaccine out to help people as quickly as possible. And that's how we're saving time. But let me say it again, not cutting any corners.
Let's go back to the scientific background was already laid. My understanding is they've been working on a vaccine for similar stuff, and now they're able to add COVID to the mix, COVID-19 to the mix, so to speak. And there's the head start. They're not starting from zero. They're starting from pretty far along on working towards another vaccine and just now implementing COVID-19 into that. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct, Paul. People were working on coronavirus vaccines. Some people will remember that we had other COVID-like viruses jump species, one called SARS, another one called MERS. People had been working on vaccines for those cousins of this virus. So all that scientific work was already done, and we can then adapt it really very quickly within a month or 6 weeks to this new COVID virus, because all that preliminary work had been done. The scientists and the laboratories had gone through all that already.
So the debate about reopening schools has been waging, and now the debate about football coming back has been waging. And Doctor, we had the two separate announcements this week, Governor Lee signing an executive order number 55 this morning, allowing for the TSSAA, where they are no longer, they're also exempt from the order of no close contact sports like the NFL and college football. So the TSSAA state of Tennessee can resume play. But yesterday, Metro Nashville Health Department issues a statement, sends out a letter to every school in Metro Nashville, both public and private, saying not so fast. We're not going to start playing until at least after Labor Day. What do you make about the two decisions and maybe the differences in the statewide approach as opposed to what we're seeing in Metro Nashville, Davidson County?
Well, as everybody probably knows, we've had two basic policies in our state. There's the governor's statewide approach, and then he's permitted individual cities to be more conservative. We've been more conservative. We have a mask order in place. That's not a statewide order. That's just for us. And so Nashville is going more conservatively than the state. And this decision about football, a major contact sport, you know, that's something that COVID virus likes, is more conservative than the statewide decision. So we see both of them consistent with those two different approaches. I'm sure it leads to a lot of questioning and confusion.
When you look at the numbers here in Nashville specifically, has the mask mandate helped at all, even as Nashville continues to heat up?
We hope that it will. It's going to take time. And part of the difficulty is that there were lots of people who were a little careless, shall we say, about the mask requirement, because we saw that downtown Broadway, particularly on weekends, the July 4th weekend, there were lots of tourists, lots of bars were open. And so we're going to have to try to regulate that and enforce it in a more sustained, complete way before we can get a major impact. But at least as I drive around and go to the grocery store myself, I think well over 90% of folks are now otherwise in their day-to-day lives trying to conform with the mask requirement.
Hydrochloroquine is a drug that we talked about going back to March and April, so it's nothing new in the discussion about it. And it's sort of waging again with people going back and forth on what exactly are the effects of this drug with COVID-19. What does the research show that you've seen, doctor, in terms of hydrochloroquine in treating this disease?
Chad, I'm going to talk to you now about the solid clinical research, not the kind of enthusiasms of individual people. The solid research indicates that hydroxychloroquine has shown no positive good effect in the treatment or the prevention of COVID-related illness. So from the point of view of all of the docs working in hospitals across this country, hydroxychloroquine is not being used currently. We're using remdesivir, we're using dexamethasone and convalescent plasma. There, the data show each of those has had some good effect.
Help me understand you mentioned different coronavirus vaccines that have been in the works for the last several years, and SARS in particular. The CDC website from the early 2000s, whatever year this was, with SARS, mentions chloroquine as some drug that they were doing some research on for SARS, which is in the coronavirus family. What's the difference between chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine?
They're both very, very similar. Hydroxychloroquine is kind of a modification of the chloroquine molecule that's very, very minor. Mm-hmm. It's a drug that isn't as dangerous to use as chloroquine. It doesn't have quite as many side effects. It has its own set of side effects, but it's not as dangerous as chloroquine.
So last week, we talked about how every week you kind of have given the broad sense of where we are as warm, with the potential to get hot, but not at hot. Keep seeing us listed as a potential hot spot, an emerging hot spot. And so I come back to the same question that we keep having. Where are we? How much are we in danger of becoming that hot spot? And where do you see things?
In Nashville, Davidson County, I think we are warm and kind of marking time, as it were. We're kind of at the same place, Paul. We see a slight increase in cases, but hospitalizations have remained reasonably flat, and we're managing that. We have capacity to take care of more patients. So we're doing all right, and that's consistent with this more conservative approach that Dr. Jahangir and Mayor Cooper are taking, and I'm very glad of that. The state itself is warming up more. It's not hot, but it is warming up more. Dr. Birx, when she was here, as I read about it, I wasn't at any meetings with her, but she was a bit more dramatic. She said Tennessee is on a precipice. In other words, we could explode and heat up at any time. But at the moment, this virus is in every one of our 95 counties and being transmitted.
Dr. Bill Schaffner joining us, and I'm sure you're following the news out there, doctor. And the Major League Baseball news is the Miami Marlins, with a bunch of players and coaches testing positive, they decide to go out and play a game the next day. And that's what Major League Baseball protocols allowed. From your perspective as a doctor, what would your advice be to a Major League Baseball team that had, I believe at the time, they knew of 8 positive tests for COVID-19? But also, what does the data show you that the Phillies were then tested after that in the days, and they've had zero players test positive? Is that maybe encouraging news about transmission outdoors as opposed to indoors in a place like, let's say, a Major League Baseball clubhouse?
Yeah, Chad. So I think, obviously, I wouldn't have recommended playing because they had so many positive players. And I'm with you. I'm kind of encouraged that the degree of contact between the teams, particularly in an outdoor environment, was sufficiently minimal that so far I think we've gotten away without any transmissions. We know that being outdoors is less risky than being indoors face-to-face for a prolonged time with somebody. And this seems to be evidence of that.
Dr. Bill Schaffner, our guest, he sits on an advisory committee with the NCAA. You met earlier this week. You're meeting again this afternoon / evening. What's on the agenda? What's the most recent discussion point? And what's the latest advice that you've added to the conversation?
Well, Jonathan, just to put it into perspective, some time ago, our committee was very sobered. We looked and we released a document which had a graph in it. And the graph was very telling because when we all started to gather back in March and April, we were all rather optimistic about sports. And then it showed clearly that across much of the country, the virus continued to be transmitted. We had anticipated it was going to go down. And so over time, our discussions have become much more sober, I want to say, and conservative, concerned about contact sports being played. We haven't made a firm recommendation to the board of directors, but they are also considering this, and their discussions, as far as we can understand, have also gotten very, very serious about this. So this is all still in play. But some of the recent issues have been, for example, what's the potential role of face masks in football? How close can college coaches, because we deal with college, get to players on the sidelines? You know, colleges like the coaches like to get right in the face of those players. And is that appropriate if we're trying to keep 6 feet apart? And how can we regulate things like that if we go forward? So large questions and also kind of details that we sometimes get into.
Is it strictly football discussion, or is it also college basketball discussion as well?
Football, basketball, wrestling, cross-country, okay. You name it. It's all NCAA sports.
Dr. Bill Schaffner with us. I asked this a couple weeks ago, and you said, you know what, I'm gonna try to check on this or do more research. Do we know if antibody tests continue to count towards a positive result for coronavirus?
You know, I have not been able to get a good answer to that question. So I apologize. I'm still in arrears.
It could be a mixed bag from different places.
The impression I'm getting is that different states may do it slightly differently.
Okay. Yes.
Got an appointment. Give blood soon, Hutton. Maybe the Red Cross will know. I'll be able to ask it there anyway.
Sure. Yeah. Final thing for me, Toronto, which is one of the hub cities for the NHL, the numbers in Canada are a complete 180 from what we're seeing here. Toronto had one positive case yesterday. That is a city of 3 million people. They have 92 people hospitalized due to COVID-19 out of 3 million in Toronto. That is a stark contrast to what we're seeing here.
It's stunning, isn't it? And I don't think we have complete explanations for that. You know, the coin was flipped during the SARS era. SARS entered Canada, and there was an awful lot of transmission, and we in the United States virtually escaped. Nobody understood that completely. I'm sure nobody understands this distinction completely either.
And the current spike, different from the first one that we saw in the Northeast, can we expect the same decline and stabilization that happened in the New York area, for instance? Is that being discussed or predicted?
we have to remember New York got very serious. Their governor, Andrew Cuomo, was really fierce about instituting a lockdown, masks, social distancing. And once they opened up very conservatively, sounds like Nashville, opened up very conservatively, and he kept insisting that everybody maintain the masks and social distancing. That seems to have worked.
Dr. Bill Schaffner has been our guest. Always informative. We always learn something, and we really appreciate this each week. Thank you.
My pleasure, thank always.
You, Dr. Bill Schaffner, or as Chris Cuomo says on CNN, Schaffner. That's all.
Thanks, Schaffner.
Didn't sound different. Oh, I just called him Schaffner.
No, just Schaffner, him. Yeah. Fishing. All right, Schaffner, let's get after it, Schaffner.
See you.
615-737-1045, our number. Coming up, we'll get back into the statement released by the Titans and in regards to Vic Beasley. And?
So Paul is the one typically known for playing media police and media security guard in the city. I'm going to do a little bit of that when we come back, and I'm going to present something to Paul and get his response to it. That's next.
Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue. This is 104.5 The Zone.
This is your home for Titans football.
The Titans intercept the batted ball in the end zone. Shane on ground. The man who tipped it, Big Jeff.
104.5 The Zone.
Midday 180. Up by Edley's Barbecue. Coming up today at 12:15, David Poyle, Predators general manager, joins us. The Preds in action this afternoon, 3 p.m., Fox Sports Tennessee. They'll take on the Stars. And what is the most highly anticipated exhibition game in the history of the franchise? I mean, we haven't seen this team play in 142 days since the stoppage. It's 20 weeks and 2 days. And we see them tonight, or this afternoon, ahead of this weekend's matchup as they enter the qualifying round of the postseason for the NHL in Edmonton against Arizona. We'll preview that series coming up with David Poyle. That's in 30 minutes. And in about 45 minutes, we will hear from Titans quarterback Ryan Tannehill.
I'm looking forward to Sunday with the Preds. I'll say that. Not as much the exhibition. I'm really looking forward to things getting started with the Coyotes on Sunday. I was really looking forward to getting news on Vic Beasley over the last few days. And I opened the show talking about this. I'm shocked that with the amount of people now who cover the Titans beat, the amount of websites that cover the team, that no one was able to uncover a single thing about Vic Beasley. And then the national people that normally break stories either don't care enough or didn't or couldn't find any information either from an agent, a relative, a friend, anyone on Vic Beasley. And that did surprise me. I was listening to Wake Up Zone this morning, and Blaine Bishop had a similar take on it where he was asking, where's the media police on this Vic Beasley story? Where's the media police on all of this? And Paul, you cover the team regularly. Are you surprised that no one was able, including yourself, to get any viable information on Vic Beasley with all of this?
First off, Blaine, it's not the media police, it's the media. The media chases these stories. I don't know what makes it the police.
Well, I think he was probably saying, where's the media police instructing everyone on how to do their job and get this story and get it out to people?
Well, I mean, if it's about everyone doing their job and the failure one time of somebody getting their job done, I invite him and everyone to look in the mirror. Look, I worked as hard as I could on the story and couldn't get anywhere. You know who else couldn't get anywhere? Vic Beasley's bosses. Took them 3 days to get in touch with Vic Beasley. So you want to be critical of the media, why don't you move up one step on the ladder and be critical of the Titans? And that's the column I had ready to go and push the button on about 10 minutes before John Robinson's statement came out. And just in case Blaine was doing a lot of media instruction here, I'll offer a reminder that Blaine and I once had a real thorough debate about his media expertise, which he lost very badly and walked out on, for which I got to spend a day at home for some reason. But Blaine has a blog that he reminded me many, many times during that conversation. I don't see him reporting anything on Vic Beasley's whereabouts on his blog. So he's welcome to be part of the media police and go ahead and get the Vic Beasley story on his blog. Him putting up the bat signal isn't getting anybody in the media fired up to go get the story for him. So apologies there. Look, everybody worked this story, and something weird's going on with Vic Beasley, and nobody could find out. The agent couldn't find out, and the Titans couldn't find out. And guess where the media mostly gets their story? The agent, the team, or the player himself. We played you the player's voicemail. I was calling the player.
All took the player.
No more primary source than the player. I'm dialing the player's phone number and texting the player. If you have a problem with the media's approach to getting the Vic Beasley story, I'll go ahead and ask you for your coaching. What should I do beyond calling Vic Beasley directly?
I mentioned yesterday it was odd that it was a surprise to see him pop up on the did not report list whenever the Titans sent out that email. And you would think on the first day of reporting for the league, that would be on a bottom line scroll. I saw it nowhere. Yeah. Same goes for Yannick Ngakoue. Yannick Ngakoue has not been in contact with the Jags at all.
Right? I didn't know that.
So they haven't talked to him. So, I mean, that's another headline here, that the COVID-19 testing has taken over everything else. That and Tom Brady reporting and throwing passes with the Buccaneers. That's it.
I will agree with the sentiment. ESPN is very guilty of doing this. They were guilty of doing it during the 9 years that I worked there. If they don't, or if they aren't able to advance a story, they tend to ignore it. It is absolutely news that Vic Beasley didn't report, and it was not on the ticker that first night. I was watching MLS for a long time. It did not make the cycle. And I didn't know Ngakoue hasn't been in touch with the Jaguars at all. Doesn't surprise me. I think it's as expected.
He's still unsigned, by the way.
Yeah, but it's news, and yes. I didn't see that anywhere. So they're unable to advance the story or to get comment from the Jaguars or off, you know, sourced stuff from Ngakoue's side or from the Jaguars. And so what they do is ignore it. And that's bad. That's bad form, I think, from anybody. And I think the way I operate and everyone else in this media thing, I mean, you would never see us not discussing the Beasley thing. I automatically wrote a piece about the Beasley thing and the inability. I wrote kind of a process story. Beasley's not here. Here's what it means when you're unable to find out anything about a player not being here. ESPN would never do a process story about that. Here's why I can't report anything on it. That's unheard of. And I think that's part of the reason people do things like I'm doing has a niche and a core of people who appreciate that.
Well, and you've got to find your info now with a niche, if that's what you want in that niche. If you want Titans news, you go to paulkowarski.com or wherever you go. But we are dumber and less informed as a country now than we've ever been before. And it's the reason I keep harping on. We cannot focus on more than one thing at a time. Hutton is right. Everything centers around COVID-19 testing and positive tests or what people said about COVID-19. There's a story now in the NBA that, you know, one player has a conspiracy theory about population diminishment. And it's been intentional with COVID-19. And that's now the story. And his coach had to talk to him. And when the social justice stuff was happening, the protests started happening, what happened to all the COVID-19 coverage?
That's right.
The virus went away in America on national outlets for what, a 2-3 week span? And then once that started to die down, boom, we're right back into it. Classic example, ESPN of all places, that's firmly in bed with the NBA. And I was shocked when I read that they're the ones who broke this story. They have a huge investigative story on the NBA in China and all of the human rights violation that went on under NBA coaches' noses. They were watching kids get physically beaten at NBA camps in China. And this is a huge report, multiple sources. It's not even on the front page of ESPN.com. It's buried in the NBA section of it. This is an enormous story as the NBA starts back. And the deputy commissioner of the NBA that's quoted in it sounds like an idiot in this story. And I would advise everyone to go read that as the NBA tries to trumpet human rights and social justice, but yet remain silent. Mark Cuban is more interested in debating Ted Cruz about other things with Ted Cruz than actually addressing or saying the name China to him at any point. It is completely worth your time to go read this story, and it's ridiculous. But we can't focus on anything outside of COVID-19. Well, so for that reason, I feel like stories like Vic Beasley and what's going on with him sort of fall through the cracks.
That one, though, is buried because they're in bed with the NBA. Right. They would have buried it anyway, whether there was COVID or not. To me, the classic.
I'm shocked they did it. Handle,
yeah, that they did it at all. To me, the classic story, and this was maybe at the very beginning of realizing that we just can't handle two stories at once, even with all of the media outlets we have, is the flood. There was a car bomb discovered in Times Square, you guys remember, that the FBI, I think, discovered, and nothing happened, but it was a big story, terrorism in New York City that was caught. And nobody knew that Nashville was underwater. Nobody. When
it's a good one.
Anderson Cooper got here 3 days late, he apologized and said, I can't believe I wasn't here sooner. And he was the first guy and the only guy that talked like that. But we were underwater for 4 days before anybody knew about it because there was a car with a bomb in it in Times Square. I mean, it's unbelievable, the degree. I mean, here's the thing you should be doing as a national news outlet. When one thing is oversaturated with coverage, you look for the other thing and go own the second story. And it doesn't work that way anymore. It's ridiculous.
Now, just to center back to the Beasley storyline for a moment. I am not trying to insinuate that Adam Schefter isn't digging at that or Ian Rappaport doing the same. I mean, they tweet out all kinds of news, you know, the random storyline. And even they didn't have anything on that. I mean, there was radio silence from the Beasley camp and from the Titans up until today with the statement from J-Rob.
Right. But when Brian Arault or Todd France says,
yeah,
I haven't contacted him, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
They go on to, like you said, 10 other stories.
Right.
And they're not working it. There's nothing to work. The agent will get back to them.
When you're right. That goes to your point.
That's the extent of it. Right. Now, my deal is to try to dig in different directions. It's a much more important story to me while they're moving on to, you know, 31 other teams and three stories on each of those teams or whatever. They're not chasing it in the same way. And they don't care about it when the agent says, I haven't even talked to him. Then they're pretty sure they're not going to hear anything. They're not going to get beat on it.
Preds play today, 3:00 exhibition. David Poile will join us in 20 minutes. Coming up in roughly 35 minutes, we'll hear from Titans quarterback Ryan Tannehill. Some other headlines from David Reed when we return. Also, the NBA does actually tip off tonight. Two games, New Orleans and Utah, and the Lakers and Clippers tonight in primetime on ESPN. Midday 180. All right. Queued up by Edley's Barbecue, 104.5 The Zone.
Get more content from Jonathan Hutton, Chad Withrow, and Paul Kuharski on the 180 at 6. Tonight from 6 to 7 p.m. on 104.5 The Zone.